This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The only way to do this in the present structure of the economy with current technologies is to talk about a planned economic recession, a planned withdrawal from nature in the sense that we cannot continue to sustain current levels of impact and expect to survive.
What makes a mild-mannered biology professor call for a planned collapse of the economy? Canadian scientist Bill Rees would know. He's an inventor of the ecological footprint concept, and he's been measuring our impact on the planet for decades.
So if you add up the total aggregate human ecological footprint, it is greater than the biocapacity of the planet. Now you can ask, well, how can that be? How can we be consuming more than there is? And the answer is by drawing down the bank account. For that reason, we can be in a state of overshoot for some considerable time before a collapse is induced.
Now he's worried about survival, ours and all living systems. I'm Alex Smith. As I welcome you to Radio EcoShock, two capitals are war zones, Bangkok and Kingston. Another is flooded in Poland. Most Western capitals wrestle with deep economic woes as stocks drop daily, as cities and states totter on the edge of bankruptcy. The largest American river delta is flooding with oil during the warmest global spring on record. The causes are well known, but why can't we do anything about it? Is it possible technology has outstripped the slow evolution of human brains? Are we too stupid to survive? In this program, you will hear a milestone lecture by Dr. Bill Rees about our three brains, the reactive reptile stem, mammalian emotions, and the late-coming attempt at rationality. Which wins? Rees was invited to address a meeting of World Federalists in Vancouver, Canada. Conspiracy theorists and New World Order freaks can relax. The venue was almost incidental to this summary of four decades of research into the human predicament. Even here, technology intervened. The mouse cord was too short to allow Dr. Rees to stand near his computer. The professor, inspiration to more than one generation of ecologists, stood by my bare microphone, speaking 53 minutes without notes. His delivery was perfect, the message pressing and clear. From a room in the Unitarian Church in Vancouver, Canada, April 15, 2010, here is Dr. Bill Rees.
I've got a lot to cover. I have to say at the outset that some of you will be uncomfortable with parts of this. It's not easy, but I don't apologize for that. Life isn't easy, and we're clearly going through a very difficult period as a species on the planet right now. As Leonard already told you, I've spent a fair amount of time thinking about some of these ideas, and in particular, as an ecologist, I've spent a lot of time measuring the kinds of things that are indicative of humankind's relationship with the rest of nature, the ecosphere. And through that whole period of my career, I think it's fair to say that things have been going downhill at an accelerating pace. So the question for me, it's not as if we're ignorant of this. We've known about it for some time. The environmental movement is 50 years old, even almost as old as my career, so it's not news to anyone. We advertise ourselves as an intelligent species, a species capable of logical thought. We pretend that we are capable of forward planning. I teach in a planning school. We act as if we are compassionate toward others. Recently, there's been a great increase in the interest in human compassion. And yet, if you look at the way we behave on the international stage, there's not much evidence of intelligence, forward planning, or compassion. And I think perhaps the most recent global example would be the, in my view, gross failure of the Copenhagen talks around climate change. So the question to me is, well, what is going on here? Why is it that our self-image, this notion that we are evidence of intelligent life on Earth, seems to deviate so much from the facts of the matter? Now, obviously, much of what I'm going to say is open to interpretation, and that's fair enough. I'm just going to give you my interpretation that comes to me as a biologist teaching, though, with sociologists and economists and political scientists and so on. So a lot of their thinking has rubbed off on me, and I've simply tried to insert a perspective that isn't all that common out there into the whole debate around global change, and particularly humankind's relationship to that change, the fact that we have become the primary driver. This is one of the earlier, more, I suppose, strident warnings of the difficulty we seem to be in. Going way back to 1992, the year of the Rio Conference on Environment and Development, which didn't get very far, and I think in some ways this statement was a response to that. This is the Union of Concerned Scientists issuing a warning to humanity. Many of the Nobel laureates in science signed on to this particular document, but the bottom line is pretty clear. A great change in our stewardship of the Earth and life on it is required if vast misery is to be avoided and our global home is not to be irretrievably mutilated. That's not the usual modest, reserved language of science. And so this is a rather outspoken statement coming, as it does, from the Union of Concerned Scientists. If you were to plot global events against the time that this particular statement came out, you would notice it had no effect whatsoever. This is a much more recent statement, a decade and a half later, from the Millennium Ecosystem Summary Report. I was a part of this document, as were 10,000 other scientists around the planet. The largest study ever taken of the state of the world's ecosystems, the systems that sustain human existence. And again, it comes out with a stark warning that human activity is putting such a strain on the natural functions of the Earth that the ability of the planet's ecosystems to sustain human endeavor can no longer be taken for granted. Now, again, not a reserved statement. Problem again is that if we plot the actual impact of humankind on the planet, you cannot see any evidence of an awakening, of a coming to consciousness of the reality of that relationship, if indeed it is real. This is just a plot of the human ecological footprint. Now, this is something, again, that I've developed with my students. I want to define it for you. Your ecological footprint is simply the area of productive ecosystems required to produce the resources that you consume and to assimilate your waste output. And it's an exclusive area. Obviously, the grain land that you use can't be used by me. So we're all competing with each other for the limited biocapacity of the planet, whether we're conscious of it or not. Here is the simple reality. The average human needs about 2 hectares to sustain the average lifestyle on Earth. That includes the assimilation of carbon dioxide and other waste, but primarily then its consumption in the third world. Waste production to a very large extent enters into this in the first world. Canadians use about 8 hectares. So we're 4 times above the world average. Americans, almost 10 hectares, about 5 times above the world average. The point then is that the Earth is growing in population, the per capita footprint consumption is increasing even faster, and so we pass sometimes in the 1980s the point at which the average consumption on Earth exceeded the average capacity of the planet to maintain that level of consumption. So if you add up the total aggregate human ecological footprint, it is greater than the biocapacity of the planet. Now you can ask, well, how can that be? How can we be consuming more than there is? And the answer is by drawing down the bank account. Ecosystems are like bank accounts. They're productive assets. A fish stock will produce an annual interest of catchable fish without being depleted. A forest adds a couple of percent a year in terms of total biomass. We can harvest that sustainably. But if your forest is adding biomass at the rate of 2% per year and you're harvesting at 4 and 5 and 6% per year, you're depleting that asset. You've exceeded the productive capacity of the forest or the fish stock or the soil or whatever it might be. So we're in a state of overshoot, exceeding the productive capacity and assimilative capacity of the planet. That's what climate change is all about. More carbon dioxide then can be assimilated by the photosynthetic processes of green plants. And for that reason, we can be in a state of overshoot for some considerable time before a collapse is induced. Things are getting worse. This is a quote from a paper just a few months ago, well, I guess toward the end of 2008, so it's over a year old now. It was one of the very first papers in the science of climate literature which actually made a political statement. Scientists are generally refrain from getting engaged in political debate. They like to believe that their work is value neutral. They simply put it out there to be assessed by the people and by politicians. In this case, Anderson was slapped on the wrist for having gotten his nose a little bit too far into the political pie. But the point is that the statement stands as a pretty remarkable one in the scientific literature. This study indicated that by examining previously unaccounted for sources of carbon emissions and a number of other things that aren't included in the standard models, that we're on a track to reach about 650 parts per million of carbon dioxide equivalents in the atmosphere later in this century. The pre-industrial level was 280 parts. We're already at 390 parts, and the trajectory is an accelerating one. The rate of increase is increasing every year. At 650 parts per million, we can anticipate a global temperature increase on average of about 4 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. To avoid this, they argued, that unless we can reconcile economic growth with unprecedented rates of decarbonization, we need to be reducing by about 6% per year our use of fossil fuels. The only way to do this in the present structure of the economy with current technologies is to talk about a planned economic recession, a planned withdrawal from nature in the sense that we cannot continue to sustain current levels of impact and expect to survive. So if we go on to the next slide, this is what a 4-degree world would look like. The yellow and brown bits are areas that become virtually uninhabitable. The brown is desert, essentially. The yellow is much dried out. And you can see from this that China, India, much of South America, Africa, areas where 3-4 billion people live will become virtually uninhabitable if this particular model is correct. This means massive translocations of people, migrations of tens or hundreds of millions of people from their homes by the end of this century. We're by no means prepared even to discuss this kind of possibility in polite company. Certainly it's not something that the Harper government in Ottawa would even allow to be brought forward for a point of discussion. But I bring it to your attention because it is serious science. And just a year ago, Australia looked pretty much like this. The southern part of the country, which had never reached 40 degrees Celsius before, was seeing temperatures of 47, 48 degrees, for example, in the Melbourne region. 8 of the 10 hottest days in the instrumental record occurred in the same 10-day period in Tasmania, the little island state at the very southern end of Australia. So every now and then we see a portent of the future occurring locally, and the problem is that if we see a 4-degree world, the kind of situation that happened in Australia a year ago will become more or less normal if the science is correct. And believe it or not, despite the enormous efforts and hundreds of millions of dollars spent by big coal and big oil to deny the correctness of the basic science, there's no reason, in fact, to doubt that the basic science, particularly the greenhouse effect, which has been understood clearly since the middle part of the 19th century, there's no reason to hold it in doubt. Incidentally, in just the last 50 years, the area that we call the tropics has expanded by about 275 kilometers on each margin toward the poles. So as the Earth warms up, we're seeing in the migration of species, in the shift of climate belts, the effects today. It's not a question, is global warming occurring? It is occurring, full stop, period. You can dispute a little bit, perhaps, how much human effect there is in that observation, but I think the only what we call forcing mechanism sufficiently strong to explain the climate change observations to date is the increase in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere since the beginning of the industrial age. There are lots of other factors, but none of them have changed nearly so much as that single factor for which humans are responsible. So just think about that if you're harboring climate change doubts and try to reconcile it with your doubts. Now, I started out in my introductory remarks by asking this question. In the face of the evidence and our non-response to it, how can we claim to be intelligent? We have this unique capacity for logical reasoning, for forward planning, for compassion toward other species and other human beings. And yet, we don't seem to exercise that very much. No corporate entity, no national government, no major international organization has begun to take seriously, or at least to act in a way that reflects the seriousness of the scientific data that suggests human beings are changing the nature of the ecosphere in ways that may not be amenable to the future of human civilization. That's simply the facts of the matter as I see them. And the question then arises, why is this? If we're all of those things, if we have these unique qualities as humans, and yet fail to respond to evidence that our own action is putting us at risk, what's going on here? And so perhaps naturally enough, as a biologist, I fall back on my biological roots. And I remember reading and having a light go on in my head when Theodosius Dobzhansky, this goes way back to the 70s actually, wrote in a paper and later a whole, I guess it was a phrase in a paper, and then he put a whole paper out basically on this topic, that nothing in biology makes sense unless you can interpret it through the lens of evolution. Now, if we can go on, I argued that human beings are products of evolution. The human brain is a product of human evolution. Human social behavior, we are social animals. We're not individual animals, solitary organisms. We're social organisms. That's a fact that comes to us from the evolved nature of our neurosystems. We are not solitary. We're social organisms. Most of our instinctive behaviors derive from the brain. So given that we're as much a product of evolution as a slime mold, there's no reason to think that nothing in human affairs, rather, makes sense, except in the light of evolution. Now, I'm not for a moment saying that that's the only quadrant in which we can extract valuable information to explain human affairs, but it's something that we don't think of. So what I want to do is to at least open the possibility that in what we are observing here, this disconnect between what we claim to be and the way we act may in fact reside in something that we aren't conscious of precisely because we tend not to want to think of ourselves as just another species. It's an insult to people to think that they are merely an animal, for example. So what I'm going to argue for the next few minutes is that whether you like it or not, folks, we are the product of evolution, and our evolution is controlled, as the evolution of other species is, by our genetic makeup, but also, and more so than in any other species, by something we call our mimetic makeup. Genes are nuggets of biological information or genetic information that can be passed from one generation to the next. A meme is a nugget of cultural information that can be passed from one generation to the next, but also within the generation. Memes accumulate over time. Cultural information accumulates. Technology improves. The libraries get fuller. We acquire more and more knowledge. And we act out of that knowledge as much as we act out of our genes. So human evolution is a codependent product of the interaction of genetic information and the mimetic information that is a reflection of our culture. Now, the second premise here is that, you know, we think of ourselves at the pinnacle of evolution, but we're just, you know, partway there. We are continuing to evolve, as are all other species. We're incomplete. We're not perfect. We aren't completely intelligent. We're not completely instinctive. We're in transition between a species controlled almost automatically by the impulses that are innately acquired and that, say, a very primitive organism, a lizard or a snake, might primarily act out of instinct. We may primarily, or at least we think we primarily, act out of higher intelligence. So there's a whole gradient here, and we're somewhere in the middle. If we can look at the structure of the human brain, there is some purely physical evidence of what I'm suggesting here. One of the most, I suppose, dramatic expressions of this came to us from John McLean about 3 or 4 decades ago, who proposed the human brain is a triune organism. Now, it's not as simple as this, but in general, his thesis has proved to be quite robust to tests. And what we can argue from this thesis is that there are 3 large subcomponents of the brain, each with its own kind of intelligence. The reptilian brain stem at the very bottom here is the old brain. Now, keep in mind that human beings are a species of vertebrate organism that shares in its personal development, in our ontogeny, the same kinds of transition states as do other organisms that are vertebrate animals. And as the human organism evolved over time, we obviously had to start from where we were. So at one point when we were much closer to reptiles, the brain basically had that structure. When mammals evolved, they added to that structure. They didn't abandon the instinctive centers of the brain. Down here is where all the automatic functions take place. You're not conscious of having to breathe. You don't control your heart rate. It's all taken care of for you automatically down there, as it is in other much more primitive organisms. So as mammals evolved, they acquired this middle brain where our limbic system resides. And this is the seat of our emotions and our affection for one another. The feelings, responses to food, sex, and so on and so forth come from that part of the brain. Humans have added, more than any other organism, something called the neocortex, the third great layer, as it were. And this is the seat of our intelligence, our capacity for forward planning, our capacity for compassion, the thought centers, the language centers, and all of those so-called higher functions that we exhibit to a much greater extent than any other organism. So in many respects, humans have 3 brains, all operating at the same time, each influencing the other in a very tightly integrated way, so that at any point in time, you may not even be conscious of which part of that brain is actually in control of your actions. There isn't a person in this room who hasn't given in to some emotion and then resented it or regretted it afterwards. There isn't anyone in this room who hasn't done something a shameful that comes from the reptilian brain stem that they regretted afterwards. And there isn't anyone in this room who hasn't at some point made an intelligent decision to override some less, let's say, more primitive urge and therefore shown that we are capable on rare occasions of allowing our intelligence to override some of these other more instinctive or emotional kinds of responses. So the point is, it's a big mixed-up package, and we're perhaps in transition toward the upper end of the spectrum, but we ain't there yet in its entirety. So there's tension in this integrated mind. We think we are uniquely self-conscious and rational, so we live in that cerebrum. But there are circumstances in which reason predominates and other circumstances in which it does not. And I'm going to argue that reason dominates in relatively trivial circumstances or unimportant ones, okay? When your safety or your survival is at stake, when your socioeconomic status is at stake, when your political position is at stake, you will fight to conserve and retain your prestige, your wealth, your power, and you're not often and or even usually acting out of intelligence. It's much more instinctive or emotional at that level. So what I'm arguing is then that under these circumstances, innate behavioral propensities that operate beneath consciousness in the midbrain and reptilian brainstem will override your rational behavior. Passion and instinct will trump reason in many, many circumstances in both ordinary people's lives and certainly in the political arena. We see it daily on the news. And by the way, we seem to pay a hell of a lot more attention to ridiculous things such as the current kerfuffle over who, well, somebody was arrested for drunk driving and his wife happened to be in the cabinet and how come he only got a $500 fine? This is not exactly earth-shaking stuff, but it appeals to that human connection, that middle part of the brain. It doesn't quite reach the higher end. All right, shall we move on? Now, it's not as if this is news. I've put it in kind of a modern context. If there's anything to, if not literally the triune brain and this mixed brain model, then, you know, going back hundreds of years, the philosopher Mirandola recognized in human behaviors exactly the kinds of tensions that I've been talking about. This is the Renaissance philosopher who wrote a marvelous article, I don't know what you call it, almost a book on that you can download from the web. Man was created by nature in such a way that that reason might dominate the senses. And by its law, the law of reason, all rage and desire of passion and lust might be restrained. So there's that tension again between the reasonable, rational man having to control the more instinctive and passionate aspects of the character. And in fact, some would argue that God was invented as a kind of threat to make sure that we did this. So he goes on to say, but when the image of God has been forgotten, we begin to serve the beasts within us. So again, it's this notion that we are this compound individual, this individual intention, and we create social constructs, such as our religions, to help reinforce the kinds of behaviors necessary for civilized existence to take place. Now, Antonio Damasio, the second quote, is one of the most well-known neuroscientists today, who studies the brain function, the functions of the nervous system, and he's saying exactly the same thing, but in modern language. There are potions in our own bodies and our brains. The brain is a gland that generates hormones. It's the hormones that stimulate the kinds of behaviors that I was talking about a moment ago. So there are potions in our bodies and brains capable of forcing on us behaviors that we may or may not be able to suppress by strong resolution. So again, you've all been in situations where you know you shouldn't do that, but you go right ahead and do it anyway, because in that case, you weren't able to suppress that strong emotion by acting rationally. Mirandola and Damasio, although they were 500 years apart, are really tapping into the same sensibilities about the nature of the human organism.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are listening to a lecture by Dr. Bill Rees from the University of British Columbia, Canada. The title is Humanity Inherently Unsustainable? After explaining years of research showing humanity has passed a biological condition known as overshoot, Rees is examining an evolutionary weakness in our brains, which may explain our failure to react to dangerous threats to our own survival.
This is the best cartoon I've ever seen in my life. I wish I could credit the, Makoff, I guess. I'm not sure where it appeared. But here it is. This is our modern world. And it's every morning I think of this cartoon when I read the paper. Because the first section will be full of the latest, climate event or catastrophic collapse of this, or the soils are eroding there or something, and so on. But on the business pages, there's not a hint that they're even in the same planet, right? So here we have a Chamber of Commerce meeting in which the guest speaker has obviously been reading both parts of the paper, doesn't want to disappoint anyone, however he said. And so while the end of the world scenario is rife with unimaginable horror, we believe that the pre-end period is filled with unprecedented opportunities for profit. Now, the whole of the greening of business, in my view, fits nicely into this particular a characterization. When we look at many so-called green enterprises, they're nothing of the kind. It's a kind of a greenwash over what they were doing anyway. And I've been in a number of meetings where I've heard senior executives say, of course we're interested in sustainability. And so we're greening our company. But as soon as it starts to negatively affect the bottom line, we're out of here. That's a direct quote from a senior executive in a corporate entity right here in Vancouver. So this is not far removed from the kind of truth, again, that I'm trying to get us toward. So the private sector is responding to the profit potential in the massive trade in carbon credits, for example. If you think about what has been the principal response of nations to the rapid melting of floating ice in the high Arctic, to move in and claim territory to get at the oil that's causing the problem in the first place. So it doesn't matter where you look, you see these tensions and these manifestations of this conflicting neurological disorder that we have emerging. I'm arguing, for the sake of getting you all excited here, that unsustainability, that the state that we now find ourselves, is an inevitable emergent property of the interaction of the human species as we currently think. Okay, it's the modern mind interacting with nature. Because the way we think in terms of the beliefs, values, and assumptions under which we operate, particularly in our economies, are so far removed from the way in which natural systems function that there is no way that you can compatibly integrate the two. So if you have two systems that are so fundamentally different in their structure and operation and try to merge them together, unsustainability is an inevitable emergent property. I'm going to argue that both genes, that is to say our natural genetic behavior, as well as our cultural belief set is involved in this. And I'm going to further argue that the behavioral adaptations, or rather the behavioral drivers in this, the innate qualities, were once adaptive. They stood us well 50,000 years ago when the environment was relatively constant. But when we're in a situation of rapid environmental change, they're no longer adaptive. So we have literally made ourselves maladaptive to the very ecological or environmental conditions that we ourselves have created. Now, here's the kicker, and there's plenty of evidence in our history. What happens if a genetic mutation is maladaptive to the environment in which the organism carrying that mutation finds itself? Well, it's wiped out. So if you have a maladaptation, you will not survive. If you think in a maladaptive way, if your mimetic constructs, if your cultural paradigm, if your worldview, if your ideology is inappropriate to the circumstances in which you are expressing that ideology, you will be selected out. So I'm arguing here that just as bad genes are removed by natural selection, so can bad memes, mimetic constructs, be removed by natural selection. And that's the basis for arguing that whole societies have failed, have collapsed historically because they refused to change their beliefs, values, and assumptions in the face of contrary knowledge. Now, where did we start this? We are seeing knowledge from many disciplines piling up to show that we're on a wrong tack. And yet we do not respond because we stick rigidly to a particular set of beliefs, values, and assumptions about the economy, about growth, about a whole variety of things that are completely at odds with the nature of the reality within which we find ourselves embedded. So we're no different from previous cultures that have gone down as a result of that dilemma. So let's then look in detail at the drivers I'm talking about here. Human beings, as I said, are evolved species, just like any other. What happens if you drop a single bacterium on a petri dish of nutrients? It becomes a colony, and within a few days, under ideal conditions, it will completely cover that petri dish. It'll just keep replicating and replicating every 15 or 20 minutes until all the resources are used up and the entire space is covered. and then it dies out. Actually, the bacteria cells have the advantage of being able to sporulate, and then they blow away to find another petri dish or dead fruit or whatever it might be. But the point is, every species has two tendencies that humans share. The first is a tendency to expand to fill all the potential habitat. What do you think is the species, the large-scale vertebrate species, with the largest geographical range on the planet? Okay, it's sitting in your seats. So we are just much better because of our intellect, our cumulative mimetic endowment, at exploiting the habitats on this planet, so that no habitat that is even remotely capable of sustaining human life does not have it. We are there in numbers on every habitable landscape on Earth. And we will, like other species, use up all available resources. Now, this one a lot of people have problems with because they'll point out this or that indigenous culture that has not destroyed its habitat. And I would argue that in the case of humans, whether or not we are able to use all the resources is technology dependent. And I'm not going to get into a big argument about this. I think I can sustain that if I had to get into such an argument. But I will illustrate it in a different way. How many of you own a credit card? Okay, not only will humans use up all available resources, but when you run out of resources, you will invent one called a piece of plastic, which enables you to use up even more resources that don't yet exist, and you have to go out and earn to pay down your credit card. This is a predisposition. How many of you have gone to a buffet, eaten your fill, and said, that's it, this is the last canapé I'm going to touch? And within 3 minutes, you're back there, almost unconsciously, eating. And you know, you've done this, haven't you? You've picked it up, you've got it in your mouth. Damn, I wasn't going to do that. Well, guess what's working, you see? That's that little reptilian brainstem just trying to stuff you because, you see, under primitive conditions, you wouldn't leave food lying around. It would rot. So there was an advantage to cramming yourself as full as you could when you had the food available and packing it onto your butt and your tum for those lean times. It is by no accident that the northern hemisphere, well, I shouldn't say that any longer, that the rich people on this planet have among their numbers, of course there aren't any in this room, but about 1 billion people who are obese, precisely because they cannot keep their fingers out of the cookie bowl. We will use the available resources to which we have access. There are another 1 billion people who are malnourished at the other end of the income spectrum, all of which is just to illustrate a simple point. We're no different from other species. We'll use all the habitat and we'll consume all the resources. We are also characterized by certain qualities that make us out to be what is called a K-strategist by biologists. Different species have different strategies by which to propagate themselves. Some do so by having an inordinate growth rate or potential growth rate. They produce prodigious numbers of eggs or seeds. So if you think of a codfish that maybe 2 meters long, a big full female, 30,000, 60,000 eggs. If you think of an alder tree, one of our more adapted opportunistic tree species in this area, thousands and thousands of winged seeds. They're called R strategists, R for rate. They get by just spreading seeds all over the environment, and not one tiny fraction of 1% ever grows. That's all you need, one to replace the tree, but billions of seeds or eggs go out there. So that's a strategy. We're way over at the other end of the spectrum called K strategists. R strategists tend to have short lives, prodigious reproductive potential, no parental care whatsoever. Codfish do not look after their 60,000 offspring, for example. K strategists, long lives, relatively large, low reproduction rate, large degrees of parental care, high survival. Most of our offspring survive today, for example. And so humans are characteristic K strategists. Now, what K strategists do always is press up against the carrying capacity of their habitats. This was Malthus's great insight. Humankind will press up against the carrying capacity, the food limits, whatever it might be, of their habitat. So resource depletion, pollution of the environment, overcrowding, other symptoms of this nature. So humans are classical case strategists, always with that tendency to press up, which simply, again, is another way of saying we will occupy all the habitat and use all the resources. Next question. When the cap of carrying capacity has been removed, so for the longest period of time, humans survived at carrying capacity. In fact, we could draw this way, way back here, a flat line for 50,000 years. There were ups and downs as civilizations or local communities rose and fell, but for the most part, growth is not a persistent phenomenon in human or any case strategist population. Then we found oil. And oil gave us access to everything else. More food, more resources of every kind to create the infrastructure we needed to sustain more and more people. And so more and more people came along. Only 8 generations of people have really experienced a consistent period of growth, sufficient so that they would notice it really in their lifetimes. Almost everything important about modern technology didn't exist when I was born. Certainly not that camera, these computers or projectors or anything. Change is just inordinately fast today. It's a unique period in history. It's only been since the 1950s that any government on planet Earth has taken growth to be an important part of its economic platform. Do you realize that? Only since the 1950s has economic growth been the part of any official government economic platform. It took us, 5 or 6 generations to really figure out that we could use this. So the point I'm really getting at here is that what each of us in this room takes to be the norm, well, of course growth is normal, we need 3 or 4% just to keep the economy on its feet, is really the single most abnormal phenomenon in the history of our species. Now again, there have been other cultures that have risen or fallen, but the time dimensions are different and the scale is different. So in the 20th century, we saw a 4-fold increase in human numbers in just 100 years alone. Completely unprecedented. Just a couple of things. Some of you may yet be thinking, well, surely we don't use all resources. There's actually been studies of the history of human resource exploitation. One of the more famous ones was undertaken by 3 of my colleagues at UBC in the 90s. This is a quote from an article in Science. Although there's considerable variation in detail, there's remarkable consistency in the history of resource exploitation. Resources are inevitably overexploited, often to the point of collapse or extinction. That is a fact of human resource exploitation as our technology improves, and we will take the last one, unless powerfully restrained by international regulation or some other form. This is where federalism comes in at either the global or national. You need a basis in law to inhibit what humans would otherwise do naturally. Okay, so that's the history. Next, here is a perfect example of non-response to science. This is not a short time period. From 1962 to 1992 is a 30-year period during which Canada had management responsibility for the world's largest fishery, a fishery that had sustained human fishing for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And we watched, over that period of time, the steady decline in the spawning stock biomass to the point where it collapsed in 1992. Now, 18 years ago, we stopped fishing and the stock has not recovered. Now, the fish haven't disappeared, they haven't gone extinct. But the impact of human exploitation has so altered the ecosystem structure that the fish can no longer, exploit or retain the niche that they once occupied within that particular ecosystem. So it's not clear that that stock will ever recover without some other knock of some kind or other pushing them back into that original state. But this is a shameful example of ignoring the scientific data that something is awry here. I won't go into the details, but it was quite clear for many, many years before the collapse actually occurred. One more, and this will be the last bit of evidence that we are like other species, only more so. A group of scientists just this about 3 years ago now, actually it's not, it's 7 years ago, it shows you how quickly my memory fades, compared human beings to 96 other species very similar to humans in their ecological requirements. And they measured 12 different qualities or characteristics. and they found that in almost every case, humans were the outlier. Now, that's all biology. What has culture got to do with this? Because I'm often berated by sociologists and political scientists for underplaying the role of culture. Now look, there's a hell of a lot more sociologists and political scientists out there promoting culture, and there's very few biologists who are willing to stick their neck out the way I am, so I don't apologize for trying to put the biological argument forward. But I want to now bring in the cultural and show that it actually reinforces the biological. So this is actually a combination of culture and biology. Humans are a myth-making species. Sociologists talk about the cultural narrative. Every culture has its narrative, its origin myth, its destination myth, and a whole lot of other mythic constructs that make us behave and so on and so forth. All right? So we need stories. In fact, it's the shared mythologies, the shared stories that make this group different from that group. And look at how this disrupts geopolitics. You've got the Muslim group of myths in conflict with the Christian group of myths. And these myths are extraordinarily powerful, enough to get people to go out and blow themselves up in support of their particular mythic construct. I'm sorry if I'm offending anyone here, but the myths that we believe in are more powerful than even the survival instinct. That's how powerful the need for mythic constructs are in the human organism. And they are a very dominant force or prevailing force in geopolitics. Even today, we in the Western scientific tradition are no less myth-bound than any other culture. In fact, I would argue that the notion that we are a science-based culture is our biggest cultural myth. It simply enables us to ignore the reality that we actually don't behave that way at all. And there's been lots written about this. A theologian from Mount Allison University back east, Colin Grant, simply called Myths We Live By. It's a wonderful story about the human propensity for myth-making. Okay, so here are a couple of examples or statements of the current increasingly global cultural myth. So this is one that emerged with that explosion of the post-Enlightenment industrial revolution in Europe and is now spreading around the world. It's the perpetual growth myth, the myth of progress. The idea that you can have unlimited growth, economic material growth, on a finite planet. Lawrence Summers was the president of the World Bank when he made this statement in the early 1990s. Does anyone know his current position? That's right. He is President Obama's chief economic advisor. Okay. He is the chair of the U.S. President's Council of Economic Advisors. Lawrence Summers says there are no limits to the carrying capacity of Earth. Remember that humans tend to press up against, well, he wouldn't believe there's any limits, so we can just go on forever, that are likely to bind at any time in the foreseeable future. The idea that we should put limits on growth because of some natural limit is a profound error with staggering social costs. Now, it has staggering social costs because we use growth as the means by which to solve the problem of poverty. See, if we can grow sufficiently so that even the thinnest slice of the pie is large enough to keep people going, then they won't bug us to share. So growth becomes a means by which we can avoid the question of more equitable distribution of the world's biological and economic output. And just to show that he's not alone, frequently quoted individuals as the late Professor Julian Simon from Maryland University, University of Maryland School of Business. Technology exists now to produce in inexhaustible quantities all the products made by nature. We have in our hands now the technology to feed, clothe, and supply energy to an ever-growing population for the next 7 billion years. Now, again, not a modest statement. This is the latest numbers I could get my hands on from the World Bank on the distribution of income on planet Earth today. Now, keep in mind that when the growth dynamic got underway, really about 50 years ago, and became the primary means by which to obviate poverty, you would think that we would pay attention to the impact of that growth on poverty. But what we see here is that, as of right now, The world's richest 20%, the 20% of the population who are the wealthiest on Earth, and by the way, every one of us in this room is in that category, right? We use about 76.6%. We get all that much of the world income, actually consume about 80% of world output. The poorest 20% of people on Earth get by on 1.5% of global output. And those ratios are worsening. So the question is, if you are an intelligent species, if growth is being designed as a means of reducing poverty, why is it that we can go for 30 years in a failed experiment and not pay attention to the fact that it's not solving the problem that we set out to do? So the share of the private consumption by the poor is in decline. Most world growth goes to the rich who don't even benefit from it. Why is this problematic? Because if we're already at carrying capacity, but we're about 25 to 30% over carrying capacity, and it's 20% of the world's people who use 80% of everything, that right away shows you that we've got a problem. If everyone on the planet today consumed at the level of North Americans, we'd need the equivalent of 4 additional Earth-like planets to produce all those resources and to assimilate all of those wastes. Now, if you don't believe that, just think about it in terms of two nations. The United States has 4.7% of the world's population. 4.7% of the world's people. It uses between 20 and 25% of everything, about 22 or 3% of petroleum, for example. China has over 4 times the U.S. population. Now, see what I'm saying here? If China achieves its goal of the same material standard as is now enjoyed by Americans, U.S. plus China is 125% of the entire global economic and biological output. And you haven't even begun to count countries like Canada, Europe, India, Africa, and so on and so forth. So that's why we have fair confidence in the kinds of numbers that our footprint work shows to be the case. We cannot, by any stretch of the imagination, reach a stable, sustainable state through growth of the world economy such that everyone achieves the material standards to even pull them out of poverty, let alone live like North Americans. So the really inconvenient truth, which we do not wish to discuss, and certainly is not on any political platform to date, are these ones. This is actually a statement from the World Business Council on Sustainable Development, or at least the output of a workshop they held in the early 90s in Antwerp, Belgium, looking at the data on material resource trends, pollution around the earth, matching this against productive and carrying capacity. That workshop concluded that in the industrial world, reductions of up to 90% would be required by the middle of this century in order to enable necessary growth to occur in the third world and to keep the whole within the carrying capacity of the planet. So this is now a version of what we call contraction and convergence. We in the rich countries have got to slow down, in fact, reduce our consumption to create the ecological space necessary for the deservedly, those who deserve to grow, so that they can come up to a decent standard. Keep in mind, there's now officially 1 billion people on Earth who are malnourished, another 2 billion who don't get sufficient, that's calorically malnourished, and probably another 2 billion who are deficient in some dietary standard or other. So we don't notice, because we've always had plenty in this resource-rich part of the planet, but the fact is that half the people on Earth are still living the Malthusian dilemma. Just based on our consumption data, that we should be in North America designing an economy that uses 80% less in absolute terms in order to, again, create the space for others to gain their fair share. Now, again, keep in mind, on Earth, there are 2 hectares of biologically productive land and waterscape. We need about 7 or 8 hectares. The average person is already using 2.5, but there are many places on Earth, particularly in grossly impoverished African countries, where people survive on 1/3 or 1/2 of a hectare. In other words, a tiny fraction of the earth space that we require. For them to go from a half a hectare up to 2 requires that we come from 7 down to 2. Contraction and convergence has to be the way if you're going to have equity on a single planet and sustainability at the same time. We should be designing a smaller, equitable, steady-state economy that maintains itself within carrying capacity. This is not difficult, is it? The concepts are easy. The getting there is the difficult part because of the conflictual nature of the human animal. Now, many people are horrified at the thought that we would have to shrink. But there's plenty of evidence to show that this shouldn't be a problem if we really were an intelligent species. Here is a graph from a book called The Loss of Happiness in Market Democracies by Robert T. Lane. What Lane documents here is the lack of any correlation, any continuous correlation, between felt well-being, between people's sense of happiness, security in the future, and all of that, and rising incomes. Today, we've, for the first time in the history of our species, reached the point where my selfish interests are identical to our collective interests. I cannot be sustainable on my own. No country can be sustainable on its own. If the rest of the world carries on down the current pathway, they will take us down with it. So instead of being able to act out my own personal selfish fantasy, I've got to begin to identify my interests with your interests, because together we can pull this off if we convince enough people that it is in their selfish interest to serve the collective interest. It's the only way that we're going to make any real difference on this planet. So a movement like the World Federalists, although I have, you know, problems with this or that dimension of it, is precisely the kind of direction we need to go at the level of creating a common cultural mythology across the planet that reinforces the inherent need that we have for a planet that works for our mutual benefit. It can't work if each of us decides always to appropriate the most we can in our short lifespan on Earth. Thanks so much for that.
That was Professor William Rees from the University of British Columbia. He is the co-inventor of the Ecological Footprint and a fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute. The speech was recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock and hosted by the Vancouver chapter of the World Federalists on April 14, 2010. You can download the full speech as a free MP3 from the Climate Solutions page of our Audio On Demand menu at ecoshock.org. Or find a transcript of the speech in my EcoShock blog entry for May 27, 2010. That's at ecoshock.info. As the BP oil sinks into the American shoreline, we'll go out with this new song by California songwriter Dana Pearson, heard first on Radio EcoShock, Black Goo Goo Is Bad For You.
Yucky, it's stinky and it's sucky. It's black goo goo. Ooh. And it's bad for you. It dirties our skies, makes temperature rise. It's black goo. Can set us free. It can save the planet. Oh, can't you see? The moment is now to harness the sun. We are the ones to make change, to make the change. Black and it's yucky, it's stinky and it's sucky. It's set us free. You could save the planet, but can't you see? The moment